Mr. Jones, World War II has been good to you. You've made a good living from it. Were they the best years of your life?
That's difficult to answer, because when you think back, you're often inclined to forget the bad parts and remember the good. My son, whenever he hears World War II mentioned, asks my wife, is that the war Daddy made all the money off of, Mommy? You know. But there were a lot of good things in it, I guess.
How do you see the war's impact on the average GI, or the ones who survived it?
Well, you mean today or at the moment?
Yes, those who survived it, and looking back, how did the war change their lives?
Well, I think it changed everyone's life in a lot of ways. I think when you've been through the crucible of combat, you come home with a different view of everything, and I think it takes quite a long time to get over that. The Army has induction centers and has methods for teaching you how to become a soldier, but it doesn't teach you how to stop being a soldier before it lets you out. You have to do that on your own.
Was the average American psychologically prepared for war?
I don't think so. That's one of the points that I try to make in this book. My generation grew up in the 30s and 20s being told that war was the most evil of human pursuits, and that war was ended forever by World War I. So we were generally a bunch of pacifists in spirit, I think, all of which is to be commended, but it was hardly a realistic picture of the 1930s, with Hitler beginning to rattle swords all across Europe and the Japanese beginning to take over half of China. So it was a bit of a shock, I think, to most young Americans when they were suddenly called in to fight this war, which they hadn't been prepared for by their mothers or by their school teachers.
Did that war show that war was not the evil, most evil of all pursuits?
No, I still think it's probably the most evil of all pursuits. There's some...
In spite of the clear-cut good and bad guys in that war.
Well, the thing is when you're getting shot at, you don't think so much about who's right and who's wrong or who's good and who's bad. I think one of the things that the maligned drill sergeants were attacked for, and after the war, and an awful lot of the fiction that came out in the first 4 or 5 years after the war, these DIs, who, as the Marines call them, are drill sergeants, one of the first things they told you was, forget about patriotism. That's not how you win a war. You win a war by being a vicious, merciless, mean son of a bitch. And they try to infuse that in everybody, and I think rightly so.
Now, you entered the Army in 1939, before the war actually began for the United States. What was your first exposure to World War II?
Well, I was I was in Hawaii when Pearl Harbor was bombed. I was at Schofield Barracks up in the middle of the island, and Schofield is right next door to the Army Air Corps field called Wheeler Field, which was bombed pretty heavily that day. And the first thing we knew about it was we heard these rumbles sort of rolling up under the ground from down at Wheeler Field. And I think everyone thought they were just doing some blasting, maybe making a new runway, until it increased in volume to the point that everyone knew that something was wrong. And we all ran outside and looked down south and saw these huge smoke columns rising. Just about that time, a Japanese fighter, or light fighter bomber, which had already dropped his bomb, came over, strafing down the street, two lines of holes popping up as he went down. And he sort of looked over at us and grinned and waved his hand at us. And everyone knew then that it was, we were in for quite an experience.
And you saw his face?
I saw the grin. I wouldn't be able to recognize him at close up, I don't think, but I got a very distinct picture of that toothy grin and the wave of the hand as he went by.
In your book, you speak of the evolution of a soldier. Now, what exactly does that mean?
Well, that's one of the main themes of the book. When I came to write it, I tried to isolate several themes. There's been so much written about World War II that I was a little afraid there might not be anything new to say about it. While at the same time, I think the artwork is very moving and very interesting to look at nowadays, 30 years later. But one of the four themes that I thought I'd like to develop was this whole story of the evolution, what happens to a man when he becomes a soldier. And I sort of use this tag phrase, the evolution of a soldier. I think the very first step is what I mentioned a while ago, how the old drill sergeants, their main purpose in life was to teach you that you were no longer an individual, but a number, a cipher, one fish in a school of fish. And I think that was the beginning of what I call the evolution of the soldier. And from then on, it got worse. But I think nothing really prepares you for combat. I don't think any amount of simulated combat can actually prepare you for what combat is really like when you're under fire for the first time or the second time. And I think that's the next big step that happens in the evolution of the soldier. And I think what happens is that, especially in the beginning of the war, the guys who became good soldiers and good infantrymen sort of had to accept that they were dead. They weren't going to get out of it. The statistics were so much their enemy that there wouldn't be much chance that in 4 or 5 years that they would survive it. Some did, but and in fact, most of the men who got in combat did survive it. But the old timers who went through Africa, Guadalcanal, Sicily, Bougainville, and then wound up in France or wound up north in the Pacific in Okinawa, these people sort of accepted that they were expendable.
What sort of feeling or mood was there at the time the war broke out? A feeling that we should get right at it and win the war, or a sense of personal excitement or fear or what?
Well, I think it was a lot like a school vacation. Everybody felt, you know, the restrictions are off. We can all live, change, you know, the 9-to-5 job was abandoned, and of course, that didn't last very long, because most of the men who went in the army found themselves in another restricted situation. But there was a lot of adventure attached to the idea in the beginning, I think.
James Jones, you indicate that war was practically a way of life to Europeans, and you say it was their tradition and heritage to fight for generations, hundreds of generations. Are you saying that Europeans like to fight?
Well, I find it difficult to state baldly that any infantry private really likes to fight. And yet there were times when all of us liked it, I think, when we had the upper hand and we weren't taking too much fire and we were moving forward or taking ground or getting a good shoot at the enemy. Then it can be very exciting. And there are moments in combat when you're really exhilarated and very high. I think Europeans accepted the act and the way of life of warfare and fighting perhaps more than the Americans did. The British Army, the German Army, the French Army, they had all this tradition of colonial wars. The First World War, 1870, the Napoleonic Wars. This is a very strong European tradition.
Of course, they've been around a lot longer, too.
The Europeans?
Yes.
Well, they had been around, but more than that, they were enemies. And when you compare the size of Europe with the size of the United States, which hasn't had a war on its own territory since our Civil War, they did an awful lot of internecine fighting there, you know, an awful lot of bloody work in a small area.
You apparently no care for the British too much because you call them arrogant, stiff-necked, supercilious, and warlike, just like the Germans.
Now, very similar to the Germans, I think.
On what do you base this attitude?
Well, just from knowing them, you know. But I think that they're also, they have to be admired for being excellent soldiers. Of course, their army tradition, I think probably I was speaking more of the aristocratic part of the society of England and of Germany when I said that. The officer corps in both those countries often came from an aristocratic tradition of serving in the army. All the younger sons served in the army. The ones who didn't inherit the estates went out to India, went to Africa, and had considerable experience in minor warfare.
Now, you say the desire to fight remains in all of us, but that doesn't mean that you believe that mankind is anxious for another war or another world war.
No, I don't think anybody's anxious for it. But I think there is a kind of basic masochism in our race, which does like fighting, and which may have some effect on the ease with which wars come about. We've been trying to eradicate that here in America, in our younger people, as they did in, amongst our my generation. But I'm not so sure it's such a... let me put it this way. Until other nations create a generation of pacifists, I would be a little afraid for our entire generation in America to become totally pacifists. But I don't think that's likely to happen.
Now, you were wounded in the war. What goes through the mind of a man when he's hit?
Well, the first thing is you want to make sure you're not dead, you know. And then the next thing is a kind of vast relief because you're relieved of your responsibility. You can get out of there. And I don't know, it's a kind of traumatic experience. You, if you're wounded badly enough to be sent back, there's a kind of a alchemic change that happens in you and in the men around you. They sort of look at you with a kind of mild distaste and a sort of slight sense of guilt as though they don't want you around. I mean, they feel that, you know, you're damaged material and they'd rather not have to look at you. And you sort of feel that yourself.
What makes a man go into combat knowing that he could be next? What is it, the fear of being punished? Or?
Well, I think that's certainly a strong part. But I also think that the esprit of his outfit and the group that he is with and their respect and liking counts for a great deal. And that's one reason that men find this intense love and devotion for each other in combat that probably it doesn't exist anywhere else. That's one of the things that the old-timers, when we get old, you know, still talk about, is this this sense of closeness with the men in your outfit that that you served with under fire.
I'm Don Swaim, and we're talking about war with James Jones, the author of From Here to Eternity and of the new picture book of the war, WW2. You know, so many people died in that war, and you saw a lot of death in the Pacific Theater. Is all death alike? Is it kind of blur in your mind, or does some of the death that you saw stand out vividly in your mind?
No, a great many things stand out vividly in my mind. I remember particularly, I go into that in the book, two corpses, two dead GIs that I saw during Guadalcanal that have for some reason stuck in my mind as symbols of what death in war was like. One of them was a man who wasn't even in our outfit and was we had taken over a hill which had been under attack the day before, and somehow this man had been missed by the medics and the stretcher bearers, and he was laying on the side of the hill in a sort of half fetal position with his knees pulled up and his arms pulled up beside his head. Somehow they'd missed him, I don't know why. But he was beginning to smell already, and it upset the men in our outfit, and they began to whistle and holler down the hill for the medics to come get this stiff out of here. And there was something so lonely about him, or what had been him, lying there, that it just stuck in my mind very strongly, very strongly. The other one was I go into that too in the book, was on the day that I was hit myself, and I was walking back. I was under sniper fire, which wasn't getting too close to me, but was enough to make me a little nervous too. And I stumbled up this hill, and as I came through a bunch of trees, I saw a stretcher lying there with this boy in it who must have been 19 years old. And he'd apparently been wounded before. He was another man I didn't know, but he probably belonged to our sister company, which was making this attack with us. But he'd been wounded and then apparently had been hit by one of these snipers in the head afterwards. And he was... It just seemed so unfair that after being wounded once, he should get hit again and be killed. I think that's what made that one stick in my head.
In the Vietnam War, we had incidents of fragging in which dissenters would roll grenades into the tents of their superior officers. Anything like that happened in World War II?
Well, there were stories about it, but I never came upon any that were factual that I know about. And I'm sure officers did get killed by their own men once in a while, but I think it was very rare. And I also think that it was probably quite rare in Vietnam, from what I can gather. However, it's like plane crashes. You know, the media pick up on every plane that crashes and sort of ignore the thousands and hundreds of thousands that don't crash, so that the one or two isolated incidents become much more important in everyone's minds than the cases where it doesn't happen.
How did the World War II soldier look upon his commander-in-chief, Roosevelt, for example? With reverence, disgust, or what?
About half and half, I guess. One of the great things that always struck me on Guadalcanal, we used to holler insults about Tojo, and the Japanese would holler back insults about Roosevelt, and some Republican lying there would say, "You're damned right he does or is," you know. It's a healthy attitude, I think.
You indicate that war was, or perhaps is, led by the upper classes, and thus the history of the war can be somewhat distorted. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I think that's quite true. And I think that's one of the main reasons that I chose to write this book in the way I did, because I think that the historical record tends to minimize the actual viciousness and personal brutality and mercilessness that goes on in the actual fighting. And when the historian says three companies attacked Brest today and wiped out a battalion of Germans or Japanese, it all sounds so clean and decent when they write it that way. But in fact, it's pretty awful. And the guys who do it and go through it are seared by it, I think, on both sides. And I think that... that ought to be recorded also.
Now, in your book, WW2, you have some examples of the work of Bill Mauldin and George Baker's Sad Sack and some of the nose art on airplanes. And I guess they were considered funny, but is it possible for real humor to develop from a war with so much death and destruction?
Oh, yes.
Kind of a macabre humor in a way, isn't it?
Well, all humor maybe is macabre. I don't know. But, you know, the classic example is the 80-year-old man who slips on a banana peel on the street and falls down and breaks his hip. never to rise again, perhaps, and everybody stands around and either laughs or has to stifle their laughter. Why do they laugh at him? Why is it funny? I think humor itself is a kind of strange thing in the first place. It's kind of a short circuit in the brain around horror in a way that saves us from having to face it totally.
You got a taste of the home front, too, when you were transferred to a hospital in Memphis after an operation on your ankle. Did civilians at the time understand what the combat soldier was going through?
No, I don't think they did, really, and I don't see any reason why they should, since they hadn't had the experience. But it was kind of a shock to come home and see everybody living high, making more money than they'd ever made in their lives before, and enjoying it. And
the war was good to them, too.
Yeah, and that was all right, but it's very difficult to explain the lack of, well, not lack so much, the different moral attitude that one had in combat. For example, there's a story in the book about some ranger sergeant that I knew and I met somewhere and got drunk with, and he was telling me about how in Anzio, his company had, his platoon, I believe, had acquired about 8 new replacements on a given day. And the next day they were sent out to make a feeling attack, which they knew would be fruitless, and that some of them would certainly get killed in it, however pointless it was. So they sent the 8 green kids out ahead of them, and of course all 8 of them were killed. And the old-timers, who had known each other since Africa and Sicily, survived it. He said to me, now, it seemed to us fair that we should send those kids out ahead. We didn't know them. We were friends. We'd gone through hell together. But he said, how am I going to explain that to my wife? Well, I think that difference in the morality of the soldier and the morality of the civilian is what makes it near impossible for a soldier to explain what happened to him. And also for the people who listen, if he tries, it makes it almost impossible for them to understand.
Your look at the Japanese is very frightening. What made the Japanese such a different enemy from what Americans were used to facing?
Well, Americans weren't used to facing any enemies at that point in time. I think the Japanese, well, they have this very strong code of, again, a great deal of it is the officer class, the aristocratic class, the educated class, but they had the Bushido code of self-sacrifice, which was a very strong element in Japanese history and Japanese social life. The whole concept of seppuku, or harakiri, is rather strange to us. And the Japanese peasant at that time was very similar to the peasants in the Middle Ages. They were just coming out of the Middle Ages, of the sort of Middle Ages of their own, the Japanese. And they were very brutal men, the peasants that we had to fight against.
Well, the Japanese took a kind of suicidal approach somewhat. Did Americans ever do this?
Occasionally, you'd find one or two who would.
But not for the same reasons.
Well, I don't know, but we have our own kind of history of bloodletting and macho and maleness. That's largely personified by the Western with us. It's more gunfighting than it is swords or knives. But we still have it, and it's a strong taste for or interest in violence. And I think it stood us in good stead in that war. And I think that's perhaps one of the things that the Japanese underestimated in us.
What about the air war? What set the airman apart from the man in the infantry?
Well, mainly was that when he wasn't fighting, he was sleeping in a dry bed. tend to get hold of some booze and even occasionally a girl. Of course, they were more highly trained, more trained as specialists, much more than the grunts in the infantry. And we always looked on them as kind of special, privileged beings in a way. But they took an awful beating over Germany, for example.
The atomic bomb. Now, in your book, WW2, you seem to feel that its use was justified, although lately there has been some evidence to believe that the Japanese were ready to capitulate without the use of this bomb. Why do you feel
well,
this way?
I read up on this whole matter very carefully. And the Japanese, I don't know what sources you're referring to, but almost everything that I have read makes it quite plain that the Japanese were going to, in the same suicidal way that the kamikazes worked and believed, were prepared, were preparing themselves to sell their home country very dearly for every foot of ground. Out in the hinterlands, they were arming the people with bamboo spears, and they were going to send them against American infantry invaders with bamboo spears.
Well, the Japanese were pretty well bottled up. Wouldn't it have been easier just to barricade them, so to speak, surround them and let them stay in that country until they could...
Well, I don't think that was possible. I don't think that anybody in the United States would want to do that. To do such a thing would mean a vast expense in the first place. It would take at least 5 years to starve the Japanese out in a siege. It just wasn't practicable. Then again, there was a very strong feeling in the United States that the Japanese had coming to them anything that they got because of the unwarranted attack that they had made at Pearl Harbor.
After the bomb, what happened to the United States' stature in the world? Was mom and apple pie and baseball kind of gone?
No, I think I attempt to deal with that in this book in a small passage. I think that the whole concept of the atom bomb was so kind of terrifying that it began to be an overt symbol. I think that much of this was begun by the French intellectuals after the war and was picked up by the British and then by our own people. But America became the very idea of America making and using its bomb became a kind of, made us the arch villain. Most of us are unwilling to admit that we're a doomed race, that in fact we deserve extinction in the same way that the dinosaurs deserved extinction because we evolved in a wrong manner. I don't like to admit that myself, and in fact the press would not admit it. So to avoid that, facing up to something like that, I think the United States became the big bugbear for the rest of the world.
Well, we're
put all the blame on.
We're almost out of time, but put on your crystal, your thinking hat, or you look at your crystal ball. What's next for man? Peace, isolated war, annihilation, or what?
I don't think there'll be a nuclear war between us and the Russians. If there is, we won't have anything to worry about, any of us. So it'll be an academic problem. But I don't see that our ideology and theirs are going to ever merge. They might merge in 150 years in some form of more modified socialism, which gives the individual a certain amount of freedom, which he doesn't have in communist countries today. But it's going to take a long time. And until then, we'll be having small wars, I think.